Possible with support from the Wake the Sleeping Giant campaign, of Empty Tombs National Work that is designed to take church to the next level. More information is at www.wakethesleepinggiant.info. Today's programming is made possible in part by grants from 10,000 Villages in downtown Champaign and Crossroads Global Handcrafts, 428 North Main in Bloomington, providing income to third world artisans by marketing their handcrafts and telling their stories in North America.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. It is almost 35 years now since National Guard troops fired on students at Kent State University. On May 4, 1970, guardsmen opened fire on students protesting the U.S. invasion of Cambodia. Four students were killed. Nine others were wounded. In 1970, Philip Caputo was a young reporter for the Chicago Tribune. He was one of the first reporters on the scene. Caputo is the author of the new book, 13 Seconds, A Look Back at the Kent State Shootings. And he is our guest in this hour of the Afternoon Magazine. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion this afternoon. I look forward to your questions and comments. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. If you're listening outside the Champaign-Urbana area, use the toll-free number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let me tell you a bit more about our guest. Philip Caputo served in the U.S. Marines in Vietnam. He entered the Corps as an idealistic young man, landing at Da Nang in March 1965. In his 1977 memoir, A Rumor of War, he says, "We left Vietnam, peculiar creatures, with young shoulders that bore rather old heads." Caputo left Vietnam in July 1966 and mustered out of the Marine Corps in 1967. In his book about Kent State, 13 Seconds, Caputo says May 4, 1970 was the day when the Vietnam War came home. And the book contains a DVD of the 2001 Emmy Award-winning documentary, Kent State, The Day the War Came Home. Philip Caputo is a winner of the Pulitzer Prize and the Overseas Press Club's George Polk Citation. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with your questions and comments. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Philip Caputo, thank you so much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
You begin this book by describing the climate of the mid-60s and early 70s, and you say that some people today manifest a nostalgia for the 60s amazes you. Take us back to that time. Tell us about the atmosphere, the climate of the day.
Well, I think there was a sense throughout the country that our social fabric was beginning to tear apart under the stresses of the war, the anti-war movement, the assassinations of President Kennedy, of Robert Kennedy, of Martin Luther King, and the increasing use of violence by the civil rights movement, which had, at least part of which had turned away from the peaceful protests of King and the Southern leadership, Southern Christian Leadership Conference. It was, I think, overall an ugly, dangerous time, a very unsettling time. I say that I am surprised that people sometimes evidence this nostalgia, because I think that they may have now some kind of a hazy view of it. The haze being created by the passage of over three decades. But again, it really was a time when America was probably as divided as it had been since the Civil War.
Hmm. In March of 1970, you were here in Champaign-Urbana covering a protest. What had happened here?
Well, it was a protest that began against the recruiting on campus by certain corporations. As I recall, General Electric was one of them. And these were corporations with ties to the defense industry. And I think another issue was the use of the university's mainframe computer for defense-related projects. It was, by and large, a peaceful protest, though it had its tense moments. It lasted, I think, 3, 4, maybe 5 days at the longest. Resulted in a bit of small-scale vandalism of some university buildings, and a bit of a tussle between demonstrators and the police, but nothing terribly serious.
Yeah. About a month goes by, and at the end of April, President Nixon announces the invasion. He called it an incursion of Cambodia. How did that announcement change the unease of the country?
Well, it seemed to galvanize the not only the anti-war movement, but I think almost everybody in the country who had at least misgivings about the war, if not outright objections to it. And there had been, previous to that, between Nixon's election and the Cambodian invasion, a sense that we were getting out of Vietnam, if rather slowly, and this rather sudden surprise of a massive action involving the invasion of a neighboring country struck everyone, and I think rightly so, as just the opposite of a withdrawal from Indochina. It seemed as though it were an expansion of the war, and demonstrations on and off campus sprang up all over the country at that time. That would be April 30th of 1970.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, Philip Caputo, his latest book, 13 Seconds, A Look Back at the Kent State Shootings. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon. You can join the discussion with a telephone call, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area, anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line one in Urbana. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. I think the reason that many of us have nostalgia for that time is because it was a time when many of us felt like grassroots really made a difference, that it was not only those of us who are pacifists and anti-war, but it was a time when people were further to the center from people that were pacifists, joined in saying, I don't want my son or my grandson or my brother to go to war. And I'll just hang up and listen.
Okay. Mr. Caputo, do you care to comment?
Well, I can see the caller's point on that. But the period I'm talking about, and this would be, let's say, roughly from 68 to the end of the Vietnam War in 75, was characterized, as I say, by a great deal of violence on a large scale, from the Democratic Convention riots in Chicago to, again in Chicago, the days of rage that were staged by the Weathermen, rather frequent battles, literal battles, firefights between, say, the Black Panther Party and law enforcement officers, and I think on some campuses, certainly anti-war protesters, whatever one, however much one may have agreed with what they were saying, we're almost evidencing a kind of totalitarian impulse themselves in taking over university offices and administration buildings and virtually not allowing any point of anybody to speak a point of view that disagreed with them. And that's what I meant about that that particular segment of American history becoming, in my view and in my memory, a very ugly and very, very divisive one. As I say, and I don't think I'm wrong in this, I don't think it's purely my own perception, of an America that was, to repeat myself, as divided as it had been since the American Civil War.
Yeah. Well, a very ugly moment, of course, May 4th, 1970. When did you get the assignment to head to Kent State?
That would have been actually on the very day that the shootings occurred. Of course, you'll have to forgive me. My memory is a little bit hazy on it, but I had been called that morning, the morning of May 4th, by the, I believe it was the National Desk at the Tribune, and told that the situation at Kent State had gotten quite serious over the weekend, that the National Guard had been deployed to the campus over the weekend, and there had been the destruction, the actual arson of the ROTC building, and that I had better get there. And as I say, that was sometime in the morning of May 4th.
Yeah, and you arrived there at Kent State pretty quickly.
Well, fairly quickly. Yeah, I had to, get myself to O'Hare Airport, from O'Hare Airport to Cleveland Airport, then rent a car and drive down to Kent State. So by the time I got there, and I believe it would have been about 2 to 3 hours after the shootings had occurred. The shootings occurred while I was en route. Frankly, I don't really quite remember if it was while I was in the plane or in the rent a car. I do recall hearing on the car radio one of those news bulletins, which was very sketchy at that time because it was virtually within, as I say, an hour or so of the shootings. That National Guardsmen had opened fire on student demonstrators, and that there were casualties.
Yeah. Outside of, keeping your mind on getting there to the campus, what were your first thoughts about those bulletins, or what were your first thoughts about what you were first hearing about what had happened?
Well, it was chilling. Chilling and scary. Again, I will go back to what I was saying before. That sense of things becoming unglued and unstuck was heightened by hearing that news. I recalled that I had been on the Chicago Tribune's rewrite desk during the Days of Rage of the year before that the Weathermen had staged, the SDS Weathermen. And I remember them going down the streets and yelling, "What do you want, revolution? When do you want it now?" Sort of like a football cheer. And I thought to myself, I said, well, this boys and girls, this is what revolutions are all about, unfortunately. The soldiers firing bullets into innocent bodies.
Mm. When you got there, what was the scene like?
Well, it was eerie. The campus was virtually deserted by the time I got there, and surrounded, or I should say full of, National Guardsmen. I think there were something like about at least 600 Guardsmen on campus and another 600 in the town, a couple of battalions, in other words. And they were at fixed bayonets, their rifles were loaded, there were armored personnel carriers. at the entrances to the university, along with state police cars with their windows taped to prevent breakage in case rocks were thrown at them, and guardsmen patrolling the campus quite literally in poses that we now see on television from Iraq, walking around or checking out buildings as if they were looking for snipers. The whole impression was of a city under military occupation, which, in fact, it was.
Yeah. In your memoir about the Marines in Vietnam, you write about being in Vietnam and thinking of the U.S. as the world. And I understand that this is how people who were in Vietnam viewed the U.S. So this was kind of a general way of thinking of the U.S. And you say Vietnam was like another planet, nothing familiar out there where we were, no churches, no police, no laws, no newspapers, or any of the restraining influences without which the Earth's population of virtuous people would be reduced by 95%. Do you think Kent State turned into another planet for those 13 seconds?
Oh, absolutely I do. And not only for those 13 seconds, but for some days afterward. It's become something of a cliche, but it's true. It's often said that was the day that the war came home, and it did. It is as if a piece of Vietnam were somehow cut away from Asia and transported all the way across half the world and planted there on that little campus in the middle of Ohio. With the students becoming Vietnamese villagers and the National Guardsmen in the place of American forces.
Hmm. How long had the Guard been on the campus?
At the time of the shooting?
Yeah.
About 48 hours. I know they were alerted on May 1st and sent to Kent on May 2nd and actually deployed on campus late in the night or of the 2nd, May 2nd, or early in the morning of May 3rd in that time frame. So let's say they'd been there about 48 hours or slightly longer.
Yeah, and it was the burning of the ROTC building that caused them to be called in?
No, they had been alerted to be deployed before that. What had caused that was an anti-war demonstration that just kind of turned into a general riot in town on the Friday night and early on Saturday morning. But they were deployed onto the campus itself to clear the campus of students. I should say not kick them off the campus, but clear them from the commons areas and the outside of the campus after the burning of the ROTC building. But they were already in Kent, in the town of Kent, and around the university at the time that the ROTC building was burned.
Mm. How did the campus and how did the community feel about their presence?
Well, certainly the campus, the students, and I would say probably a lot of the professors, I recall speaking to them back then, considered them an army of occupation, were baffled, as a matter of fact, as to why the National Guard had to be called in. I think the townspeople welcomed them isn't quite the word, but were relieved that they were there because there had been a number of businesses in town that had been trashed by some of the more militant demonstrators, or perhaps by people from outside the university, outside Kent. That's never been quite clear.
Hmm. When did you first call into the Tribune?
You mean after I got there?
Yeah.
I'm pretty hazy on. I remember writing my first story, and I must have called it in sometime around 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I can remember it being near twilight. I had there had been at least one reporter, and I think possibly the only reporter, that's John Kiffner from the New York Times, who was actually there with the students when the shots were fired. And Kiffner had walked me through the area where the shots took place into the parking lot where the students had been killed. And then I had interviewed a few guardsmen and a couple of students who were packing up to leave. And so I would have probably filed that story sometime late in the afternoon or the early evening.
Hmm. Do you remember roughly what you reported?
Yeah, I've got I don't have it here with me at the moment. But,
it's in the book, I believe. Yeah.
That's a later story.
Okay.
The one that's in the book. The actual dispatch right from the scene there was. I've got a clipping of it somewhere, but it was a brief summary of what had happened, but it was more of a mood piece about what the campus looked like and felt like at that moment. So the wire services had pretty much taken care of the hard news.
Yeah. How did you go about trying to? You had some help from Kiffner of the New York Times in getting sort of a basic grounding of some idea of what had happened. But then how did you go about trying to get more information? Tell us you talked with students, and what kind of information did you get from guardsmen?
Well, it's mentioned in the book or described in the book. I went to the mess area where the guardsmen were, and I found an officer, a junior officer, a lieutenant, who was not with the troops who actually did the firing, but who was very near them when it happened. And I interviewed him, and as well as a couple of other guardsmen. Again, these were not ones who had actually done the shooting, but they had been there. And, I mean, the story they basically presented to me was the same one that their senior commanders, for example, Brigadier General Canterbury, who was the guard commander on the scene, was giving, that these students were threatening their lives, that they were surrounded by a hostile mob that was about to overrun and overwhelm them. I described it as sounding as if these were the thin red line that Rudyard Kipling would describe in one of his poems, surrounded by some hostile tribesmen. A description that was 180 degrees out from that was given by many of the students that I spoke to, and the students' description and viewpoint was later borne out by many investigations, particularly an investigation that was conducted by late Governor Scranton, the Scranton Commission report, it was called, which stated that the guardsmen were never anywhere near in danger, as evidenced by the fact that one of the students that they shot was 750 feet away from the guardsman when he was hit, the others being anywhere from 100 to 150 yards away.
So the answer to the question, were the shootings justified?
Oh, absolutely.
Has to be.
No question, they were totally unjustified. Yeah. It went, you know, they talk about excessive force. It went beyond that.
Hmm. Wasn't,
I mean, in my view, I mean, quite frankly, is I think it was outright murder.
Hmm. Was an order given?
Well, I looked through as much of the written record as I could about that. That has never been determined. There are reports that an officer or a non-commissioned officer gave a hand and arm signal to fire. or other reports that an officer or non-commissioned officer gave a verbal command to fire, and still other reports that the guardsmen had gone into a huddle. Now, that actually is a fact. They had gone into a huddle not long before they actually opened fire and had decided among themselves that they were going to shoot as a, in some sort of a darkly democratic process, you might say. So it's never been clear if they were actually ordered to shoot by an officer or an NCO. Certainly there was some kind of organization there, because when you look at the DVD and at some of the news photographs taken from there, you will see that the guardsmen are deployed in a skirmish line and firing more or less in unison. So it wasn't as if one guy just suddenly jumped out and started shooting and another guy jumped out and you had an almost mob-like action. There was something of an organized effort there.
Yeah. Well, there's also the picture, one of John Philo's pictures, I believe, with the guardsmen on their knees.
Yeah.
And there's at the bottom half of the photograph is a young person with a flag.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's an example. You can see that doesn't, in other words, look like as if the National Guardsmen themselves were in some sort of panic. Now, whether that the orderly way, if I may use that phrase, they did the firing was the result of some kind of consensus that they arrived at among themselves, or as a result of an order given by a superior officer, has never been made clear, and I doubt at this stage ever will be made clear.
Well, we have another listener waiting to talk with us this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest today, journalist and novelist Philip Caputo, his latest book, 13 Seconds, A Look Back at the Kent State Shootings. We have a listener waiting to talk with us on line 4, a caller in Indiana. Good afternoon. We have a...
Hello?
Hello. Yeah, go ahead.
I'm remarking first about that expression you said, darkly democratic way. I sure hope we're not going to get there again, though there seem to be things socially that's pointing that direction. I remember all this. I was at Chapel Hill going into the library when a friend came up to me and told me what had happened at Kent State. And a lot of my friends, I remember when we talked about it afterwards, that a lot of us, our training, we got to see photos of some of the famous paintings of troops shooting, you know, peasants and other people. And I remember that image came into my mind, and I guess you'd say the psychic residue from that period still weighs pretty heavily on a lot of us. I started with the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, is the first means of since becoming a leftist, then the repeated assassinations, and then the move into Cambodia. And I remember as a youngster, you know, I just thought, you know, the whole country was just going to go to hell. And it's still difficult to talk about. Thanks.
Thanks for the call. I remember some years ago talking with John Philo, and it hadn't been 35 years. It had been maybe 10 years. And he was still trying to, I mean, he was still, when we talked about some students at the college that I attended, we talked with him, it was almost like for him it was yesterday, and it had been 10 years.
Yeah, I can fully empathize with that. An experience like that, especially I would think, you know, for someone who had never experienced deadly violence, would be engraved in your memory forever. I know, even though I was a trained U.S. Marine officer, that there were things that I saw and that I went through in Vietnam to this day, nearly 40 years later, I can call up with remarkable clarity, and it seems to me that it happened last week.
And we should mention that John Filo was a student at Kent State.
Yes.
And he took a number of pictures there that day. And one of them
won the Pulitzer Prize.
Yeah.
For the famed picture of the Mary Vecchio, who was first misidentified, I believe, as a Kent State student, but later it was revealed that she was actually a teenage runaway. But nevertheless, she was there, and that was the picture of her kneeling over the body of one of the dead, Jeffrey Miller, and raising her hand and crying out. Became an icon of the Kent State Massacre.
Yeah. It seems to me in this book, 13 Seconds, you wanted to do a couple of things. You wanted to talk about why we need to look back and what the lessons are. You also, I think, really wanted us to know something about the students who were killed. You write, "It is necessary to put flesh and bones and personalities on those names struck into a marble slab on a hill in Ohio. Lives, not identities, were extinguished on that May afternoon." Now, we don't have a lot of time here this afternoon, but can you say something about these four young people to give us some flesh and bones and personalities?
Well, let's see, I'll try to do that as briefly as I can. First of all, I want to mention that two of the students were not even participating in the demonstrations. One was a bystander, and the other, Sandra Schuer, was changing classes when she was struck down by a bullet. All right, make it as briefly as I can. Allison Krause was a sophomore at Kent State. She was actively involved in the demonstrations, but she was not one of the weather people. She was not a bomb throwing radical. She was like tens of thousands of young college students at that time. She was opposed to the war, and felt passionately enough about her opposition to demonstrate against it. She was a very compassionate young woman with a real ability to relate to people. Jeff Miller was. There's something very sad to me about Jeff Miller. He had started off at the University of Michigan, where his older brother was kind of a big man on campus, a fraternity man and stuff like that. And Miller again, he was a young man who was opposed to the war and stood on his principles, and to give you an idea of how far away he was from the radical side, he had told his mother, called his mother, said that there was going to be an anti-war demonstration on campus on May 4th, and that he was going to attend it. And he was almost, asked her if that was all right with her. And she just told him to be careful, he told her that he felt that he should stand up for his principles. Sandy Schuer was a speech therapy major, and a young woman who was completely divorced from the demonstrations that were going on at that time. She was a daughter of middle America, if you want to put it that way, who was just trying to get an education. As I said, she was changing classes when she was shot. And William Schroeder was when you read Schroeder's biography, you almost think that somebody has made it up. This young man was such an ideal of a son. He was actually in ROTC at Kent State. He was an honors student. He was involved in many extracurricular activities. He had part-time jobs to help pay for his education. He was about as we used to say in the Marine Corps, about as squared away an individual as you could find. And he was on his way, I believe, to class or from class, and he had stopped by to just observe what was going on. He was watching the students in the parking lot who were yelling at and throwing stones at the guardsmen who were 100 yards away, who were at that moment just starting to deploy to open fire. And then I believe that he probably never even saw that happen, because from the nature of his wound, which was to the back, it sounds as if he had turned away to walk away when he was shot.
Hmm. The memorial to the students that is at Kent State today, to those students killed and those who were wounded, is kind of out of the way, hidden. Would you describe it for us?
Yeah, it's actually rather hard to find.
Yeah.
There are signs on the campus that'll say May 4th Memorial, but sometimes they kind of peter out. When I went to go look for it, I actually got lost and had to ask directions. The memorial is established or set up near where the shootings took place, at a building called Taylor Hall, and behind it is the Prentice Hall parking lot, which is where Schroeder and Miller were shot down, and Krause as well. And it's just a slab, a marble slab in the ground. When I went there, it was covered with autumn leaves. I had to brush the leaves away to read the names on it. And it's the names of the four dead and the nine wounded are inscribed on it. And then around it are these marble blocks that look like, and I guess are, benches. It's very unobtrusive, to a point that it's almost invisible. You really have to make an effort to see it. It's certainly nothing that declares itself.
Mm. With the time we have left together this afternoon, maybe you would talk with us about your thoughts about why we should look back and remember this.
Well, I think it's especially true now that, you know, that we're involved in another controversial foreign war. And we all need to remember what happens even in a democracy like ours, when passions get out of hand. And I mentioned earlier about the excessive zeal or excessive passions that came from the new left, but there was a countervailing passion and rage from, what President Nixon used to call the silent majority, maybe from the mainstream of the country. You know, it's my opinion, and I think it's an informed opinion, that those guardsmen would have never fired if they didn't think that there were a lot of people who would approve of what they were doing. And I believe that one of the things we need to remember, each one of us as an individual citizen has got to think about what he says and what he does in moments like this, in our history, that if we are irresponsible in some of our even our thoughts, but I must say in the things that we say, you could contribute to an atmosphere that leads to this kind of murderous violence, and that's something we all need to keep in mind.
And also, going back to Jeffrey Miller and Alison Krauss, citizens have a right to protest.
Well, no, I certainly believe they do.
Through peaceful civil disobedience.
Yeah, I make that point in the book that if we go back to Thoreau, who, well, you might say wrote the manual on it, in his essay on civil disobedience, is that I think people do have a right to protest. They even have a right to what you might call disobedient acts like sit-ins and so forth like that. I am I like to call myself a militant moderate. Even though that sounds like an oxymoron, in the sense that I am totally opposed to protest movements that turn to violence. And just one analogy I like to use is that if people feel that people on the left feel that, say, an anti-war demonstrator has the right to turn to violence, like burning down a building or planting a bomb, then you automatically grant license, let us say, to a right-wing fanatic who blows up an abortion clinic or starts shooting people that are going into or out of the abortion clinic, which, as we know, has happened.
Hmm. And another point that you make in the book, 13 Seconds, is that we have to be careful whom we elect and more careful about communicating what we wish our representatives to do.
Yeah, that goes back to what I was saying about being responsible in our actions and in our words. Governor Rhodes, who was then the governor of Ohio, was very immoderate in the comments he was making about the demonstrators before the shootings took place. The commanding general of the National Guardsmen, who was on the scene, made some immoderate comments like, "All right, now we're going to go teach these kids what law and order is all about," and then ordered his men to lock and load their rifles, which means that you pull the bolt back and you chamber around into the rifle. So you have to be careful. Yes, not only who you elect, but I'm rather sure that Governor Rhodes was playing to the galleries at that time. He was in a very close primary election fight and probably figured that he could garner votes from the so-called law and order crowd by making comments like the ones he did.
Let's talk with one more listener this afternoon before we have to wrap up. Caller in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hi. I wasn't listening the whole time, so forgive me if you've covered this already, but I was curious, does anybody know anything about the guardsmen that did the shooting? How did that affect them? That kind of thing. And I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
By the way, the DVD that is sold with this book has an interview with one of the guardsmen who did the shooting, a Sergeant Larry Schaefer, who shot and wounded one of the students, and quite deliberately, he admits it. I can't say that you see a great deal either in the written record or in the documentary of that much contrition on his part, and I didn't get the sense that there was much on the part of the other guardsmen, who somehow felt that what they did was justified, that they were under threat. There was a tendency at times for them to blame their officers also, which I agree with, is that they were poorly led. But I don't think that lets them off the hook though for pulling the triggers.
There we have to leave it, Mr. Caputo. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Philip Caputo has been our guest this afternoon here on the Afternoon Magazine. His latest book is 13 Seconds, A Look Back at the Kent State Shootings. The book is published by Chamberlain Brothers, a member of the Penguin Group. It's 9 minutes before 2 o'clock. Settlement prices are in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Dave Dickey.
Indeed, they are, Celeste, and it's been one interesting day on the Chicago Board of Trade, especially in that soybean pit, which showed strength for much of the day after a weaker opening this morning, only to find a sell off near the close, and giving back much of the gains that it saw on the day. We'll talk to Mike Zuzolo of Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, Indiana, during the closing market report at 2:06 to talk about the implications of the softer tone in the soybean pit. And that soybean pit did spill over into the wheat pit as well today. Let's go ahead and look at the particulars for the day. May wheat, a high of 327, a low of 317, settling 318 up three quarters. July, a high of 336 and a half, a low of 325 and a half, settling 326 down one and a quarter. September, a high of 344 and a quarter, a low of 334, settling 334 and a half down one and a half. December, a high of 354 and a half, a low of 343, settling 343 and three quarters, down one and a quarter. March, a high of 362, a low of 353, settling 353, down one on the day. May corn, a high of 206 and a quarter, a low of 204, settling 204 and three quarters, up a quarter. July, a high of 215, a low of 212 and a half, settling 213 and a half, up a half. September, a high of 222 and a half, a low of 220 and a quarter, settling 221 and a half, up three quarters. December, a high of 232 and a quarter, a low of 229 and three quarters, settling 230 and three quarters, up a half. March, a high of 239 and a half, a low of 237 and three quarters, settling 238 and a half, up one. And then the May contract, a high of 244, a low of 242 and a half, settling 243 and a half, that up one on the day. On the week, we see that May corn finished at 204 and three quarters, down four and a half on the week. The D's contract down three and a quarter on the week at 230 and three quarters. May beans, a high of 625 and three quarters, a low of 616, settling 619 and a quarter, up one and a quarter. July, a high of 634, a low of 623, settling 626 and a quarter, up one. August, a high of 633, a low of 624 and a half, settling 626, up one and a quarter. September, a high of 630, a low of 621, 623 and a quarter. The settlement, up two and three quarters. November, a high of 629, a low of 618 and a half, settling 621, up one and a quarter. January, a high of 630 and a half, a low of 620, settling 623 and a half, up two and a quarter. And if you were listening closely, you did hear indeed, it is a carrying charge market that we're looking at. We'll talk about the implications of that with Mike Zuzolo as well. On the week, May beans down 13 and three quarters at 619 and a quarter. The noves were off 7 at that 621 level. May soybean meal, a high of 196.50, a low of 193.70, settling 194.50, down 20. May July meal at 195.90, a low of 193. Settling 193.50, down 30. May soybean oil, 22.72 for the high, the low at 22.70, settling 22.59, up 36. The July, 22.82 the high, the low 22.28, settling 22.66, up 31 on the day. Settlement prices also in on the Chicago Mercantile Exchange were, generally speaking, Celeste, a higher day.
That's exactly it. Among the contracts that we follow here on the Merc, there was just one contract that finished lower today, and that was August feeder cattle. May feeder cattle, 108.95, the high, the low 107.90, the settlement 108.67 and a half, that up 27 and a half. August 108.57 and a half, the high 107.50, the low 108.10, the settlement, that down a nickel. September feeder cattle, 107.40, the high 106.60, the low 107.40, the settlement, that up 15. April live cattle, 93.95, the high 92.05, the low, the settlement 93.92 and a half, that finishing up 157 and a half. June live cattle, 86 even the high, 85, 42 and a half the low. The settlement, 85, 62 and a half, that up 2.5. May lean hogs, 78.55 the high, 77.60 the low, 78.15 the settlement, that up 85. June, 78.10 the high, 77 even the low, 77.45 the settlement, that up 75. July, 78.80 the high, 77.90 the low, 78.75 the settlement, that up 112.5. August lean hog, 75.85 the high, 75 even the low, 75.80 the settlement, that finishing up 85. And May pork bellies, 84.10 the high, 82.20 the low, the settlement today 83.12.5, that up 152.5. The Dow is up 106 points at 10,176. The NASDAQ up 14 at 1919. And the S&P 500 11 higher at 1154.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
William Fisher from Columbia, Missouri writes, "Dear Dr. Science, why is it that soda machines are always out of the flavor I want, but my friend who's standing next to me and wants something else always gets his first choice?"
It's because your friend has dared to want something else, while you're still stuck at the infantile level of desire. You want, you demand the same old thing, and the universe is tired of giving it to you. You'd be tired, too, if only you had the self-confidence and self-knowledge to dare to want something else. Soda machines are the Zen masters of modern life, and the lesson they teach those on the path to enlightenment can be learned no other way. So the next time you approach such a machine, choose anything but the flavor you want, and send yourself down the express lane to Nirvana.
Thank you, Dr. Science. Send your science questions to Ask Dr. Science. Remember, he's not a real doctor.
I have a master's degree
in science.
Produced by Duck's Breath and distributed by PRI. For information online about the Duck's Breath 30th Anniversary live show on DVD, go to drscience.com.
Today's broadcast is made possible in part by a grant from Horene's Pianos Plus, your Steinway Piano Showroom in Bloomington. Horene's Pianos Plus offers new and pre-owned pianos by Steinway & Sons, Boston by Steinway, and other fine pianos.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL Urbana, the broadcasting service of the College of Communications at the University of Illinois. It's 1 minute before 2 o'clock, 53 degrees in Urbana. Our technical